Welcome to this Forthright Radio for June 20th, 2016. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have a very full show for you today. With us for the full hour is Maya Dusenberry, journalist, editor, and author of the book Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. It's published by the HarperOne imprint of HarperCollins. Maya Dusenberry has been a fellow at Mother Jones Magazine and an online columnist at Pacific Standard. In 2013, she became editorial director of the trailblazing site Feministing.com. Her work has appeared in many other diverse publications, from TheAtlantic.com to Teen Vogue. I became aware of her work from an article in BBC.com's Health Gap series on May 29, 2018, entitled, Everybody Was Telling Me There Was Nothing Wrong. Before becoming a full-time journalist, Maya worked at the National Institute for Reproductive Health. And with that, by way of introduction, we welcome you to Forthright Radio, Maya Dusenberry.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to thank you for writing this book. It's very useful, very well researched, as the New York Times points out, but quite readable. Maya, you begin your book, Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick, by explaining that you developed rheumatoid arthritis at the age of 27, and how that led you to research and ultimately write this book. Very briefly, could you share with us this progression?
Yeah, certainly. So I have been a feminist writer for a long time, and as you mentioned, have written about reproductive health issues a lot and have a background in that. But it really wasn't until about 5 years ago now, when I developed rheumatoid arthritis, that I started kind of thinking about these issues. And once I became sick, I realized that I just hadn't thought that much about how gender bias affected medical care more broadly than just around reproductive health issues. And my experience with RA, which is an autoimmune disease where the immune system attacks the lining of the joints, was actually pretty good. I got diagnosed pretty quickly. I started early treatment. But because of that experience, I started learning about autoimmune diseases more generally and really started to see that so many other autoimmune patients were not that lucky and experienced these really long diagnostic delays, often seeing many doctors over many years and really feeling like their symptoms weren't taken seriously during that time or were brushed off as just stress or anxiety. And that was really the impetus to kind of dig a little bit deeper and see kind of what was going on there.
You cover a very broad range of illnesses in your book, from heart disease, as you said, autoimmune diseases, chronic pain syndromes, chronic Lyme disease, vulvodynia, chemical intolerance, even ovarian cancer, and in a very thorough way. And I want to make a disclaimer as we begin that I have been living with Lyme disease since 1991, which was then, as you point out, frequently happens, was rediagnosed after I was supposedly cured of Lyme disease as fibromyalgia. And I bring that up not only because it explains why this book means as much to me as it does, but also because I am in a bad session with whatever it is I have, and I'm experiencing difficulty speaking. I've already slurred several words in this broadcast. So that's what's going on. And let's talk about the history of the inequities between women's health and the research. You talk about the two problems of the knowledge gap and the trust gap. Let's start with the knowledge gap and go into a little bit of the history of that, please.
So when I talk about the knowledge gap, I just sort of mean this kind of relative dearth of knowledge that medical science has about women's bodies and the conditions that disproportionately affect them, that I think is really kind of a lingering consequence of the fact that for many decades we were really leaving women out of most clinical research. It wasn't until the early 90s that there was kind of public attention to the fact that the National Institutes of Health weren't really keeping track of whether they were including women in clinical trials. And there were really major foundational studies that would enroll something like 20,000 men and zero women, with really no kind of attention to the possibility that there could be some sex and gender differences that might matter. And so it's really only in the last 25 years that we've started to kind of close that gap by including women in more studies. But at the same time, there hasn't been as much progress when it comes to actually analyzing results to see if there are differences and making sure that information is included in published study results in medical journals. And there's also been a real lack of progress in terms of getting women included in preclinical research. So research that's done on animals or cell lines has continued to mostly use male subjects and not pay attention to the sex of the study subjects. And then the other big issue is that even as we've sort of gained a lot of knowledge over the last few decades, much of that emerging knowledge has not been really fully incorporated into medical education. So there's a sort of lingering knowledge gap that's just the result of the fact that it takes a really long time for any new knowledge, but I think particularly this kind of emerging knowledge to really make that way from the research side to actually, you know, impacting medical education and then impacting clinical care.
And you suggest that we use the term gender-specific medicine, not women's health. Talk about sex versus gender and why that is a better term, gender-specific medicine.
I'm not opposed to talking about women's health and kind of talking about the need for, because of this historical focus on men and the conditions that disproportionately affect them, I think there is a sort of lack of knowledge that just is about not neglecting sort of women's concerns. And so I'm not opposed to saying that, you know, we really, for something like fibromyalgia or vulvodynia or endometriosis, these are conditions that very disproportionately affect women and really just haven't been studied at all, I would argue in part because they do affect women. So I think that there is a need to kind of focus on women's health to kind of compensate for that historical lack of focus. But the concept of gender-specific medicine is kind of making the point that all of us, men and women, have a gender and have a sex and potentially have differences in the experience of the same disease because of that. So heart disease is the really kind of great example because there is a lot of research that's shown that men and women tend to have different symptoms and risk factors and different kind of clinical presentations. And it's obviously that a lack of knowledge about those differences really can hurt both men and women if we're not kind of taking that into account and being aware of that possibility in all of the kind of research we do.
And it brings up the idea that gender certainly is a spectrum, and so are the way different illnesses present. So only skewing the research to one gender or sex really limits the ability to diagnose diseases. I was fascinated and horrified at all the different ways there are in medicine to say, it's all in her head. And just to list a few that you talk about in your book, hysteria, somatoform or somatization disorders, psychogenic, psychosomatic. And really what they all come down to is when a condition is medically unexplained or unexplainable. Very, very briefly, go into the history of that so we have a sense of how very far back this goes.
Yeah, so I think when I started hearing these stories of women who kind of got the impression that their symptoms were being dismissed as all in their head, I sort of just attribute it to, you know, a kind of more general lack of authority that women have in a variety of realms, of course, in our culture. So it was surprising to kind of trace back the history and realize how that kind of tendency really does have these very deep and particular roots within medicine in this history of hysteria. So for many centuries, hysteria was sort of this catch-all diagnosis. for basically anything that went wrong in women's bodies. And for a while, it was attributed to a wandering womb and then to women's sensitive nerves. But by the time Freud came along and after that, and for most of the 20th century, it's been seen as this mental condition that causes physical symptoms. And medicine has really kind of adopted this tendency to just sort of assume by default that anything that they can't explain as a consequence of a known physical disease can be sort of attributed to the patient's psyche. Not because there's necessarily positive proof of that, but just because, as you said, the symptoms are medically unexplained. And yes, the terms have really kind of shifted over the years. And of course, there are very few people who are actually having hysteria written down in their chart. But that kind of concept, I think, really has remained remarkably consistent. And so when you have patients saying, I was told it was just stress, or just told, you know, well, I've done all the tests I can think of and there's nothing wrong, even though they continue to be seriously ill, is that kind of concept that doctors are sort of relying on to do that.
Could you go to talking about the different ways that heart disease presents and how it was often women who presented with eventual heart disease were told it was all in their head?
Yeah, so heart disease is not only this area where there's a lot of evidence of real gender differences in the way the disease affects people, but also real evidence that there are disparities in how patients are treated. So it's very clear that women are underdiagnosed, undertreated, not treated as aggressively for heart disease. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the disease has long been sort of stereotyped as a male disease. And that's mostly because men tend to develop the disease earlier than women do. But heart disease is still the number one killer of women in the U.S. It kills many more people every year at every age group than breast cancer. And yet many women who are suffering a heart attack, especially if they're sort of younger women, premenopausal women, so are in the sort of age group that doctors don't expect to have a super high risk of heart disease, are often treated as if it's kind of impossible for them to have heart disease at all, just because they're young and women. So are often told that it's panic attack or it's indigestion or acid reflux. And one of the most kind of striking statistics is that one study found that younger women under 55 were 7 times more likely to be sent home from the ER in the middle of having a heart attack than the average patient. And a lot of stories in the book attest to that, that women have to kind of go back again and again while they're suffering a heart attack and before they're recognized.
In sympathy with those in the medical profession who are in the position of trying to make these diagnoses, it must be very difficult when things that they have been taught are not the norm present. So mm-hmm. Let's just acknowledge that. However, I would amend the title of your book, Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick, and add, and dead. And we'll never actually know how many they are. And that's one of the things you bring out in your book is the lack of data about the misdiagnosed, because we don't keep track of that. Talk about that as an issue.
Yeah, this was really one of the most striking things I learned, and it was really kind of actually helpful to learn this. So there is really has been a real lack of attention to diagnostic errors. So that would be misdiagnoses, but also diagnoses that are needlessly delayed or missed entirely. And it's only in the last kind of decade or so that medicine has really started to recognize that this has been a blind spot, that we don't have a lot of data on how often this happens, but the data we do have suggests it's quite often. But few, if any, healthcare institutions are really sort of tracking in a systematic way how often diagnostic errors occur. And so the consequence is that individual doctors are left with a really inaccurate sense of how well they're doing. You know, they just don't get the feedback needed to really gauge their batting average. And so it's not that they're necessarily, you know, individually arrogant at all, but they do kind of just assume that they got it right unless they hear otherwise. And we have a system where the only way they would possibly hear otherwise in most cases is if the patient actually went back and said, you told me I was just stressed, and then 4 years later, four doctors later, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. And so that was really helpful to me to understand how this problem has become so entrenched and really self-perpetuating, because those first doctors that hypothetical autoimmune patient saw don't get that memo. And so they're sort of left with the impression that she really was just stressed and it was all in her head. So I think that that was, on the one hand, really kind of shocking to learn, but also points to a real place where there's a lot of potential for real change. If we could get better systems in place so that doctors are just getting this feedback, I think that could really help move things forward.
I've been guilty of that. It was a good 10 years before I got any help with my chronic condition. Mm-hmm. And I did not go back to a single one of the physicians who didn't help me and tell them, you didn't help me, and this doctor is helping me.
Right. I think it's important to say, you know, I don't think that the burden should be on individual women to do that. I would imagine that most people who have that experience like you, once they do get help, it's very stressful to be sick. It's very stressful to be searching for a diagnosis. And at that point, it's probably the last thing you want to do is go back to somebody who was really dismissive or potentially a kind of traumatic experience.
And especially if one of the primary problems is the trust gap. If the physician already doesn't believe you, if you do go back and say this other physician helped you, they'll like, oh, well, they're just kind of like pampering you or placating you or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
But I do notice, Maya, that in the last few years, just with regular checkups and that sort of thing, there are feedback mechanisms online that some of the healthcare providers are putting out. So I think, at least in some instances, that is improving. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that could be true. Yeah. And I mean, I know that sort of the just kind of more generally in medicine, there's more recent efforts to kind of improve the flow of information and sort of cut down on mistakes that happen just because of a lack of communication between different parts of this very kind of complicated and often confusing system. So yeah, I definitely think that there's so much potential to kind of be creative about getting systems in place. Also, I think that one of the reasons I'm really hopeful that my book can perhaps help inspire and support the sort of movement towards women just kind of speaking up about these experiences generally, whether it's on Facebook or in the media, I think that that kind of storytelling alone can also help kind of provide that feedback just to kind of make the problem more clear and help healthcare providers see how widespread it is. Because I think at this point, it's a problem that I think is very widespread, but is a little bit under the radar because individual women, if they've had experiences like this, kind of tend to keep them to themselves and maybe assume that it was just them, you know, it's just me. And really kind of requires speaking up about them and realizing how many other women have very similar experiences to kind of have that moment of realization that, no, it's not just me. These are widespread, pervasive experiences that are indicative of these larger systemic problems.
You talk about the organizing potential and self-diagnostic potential of the internet. And those are two different but related things. I have a hunch that a lot of doctors kind of roll their eyes at the information on the internet. And I have some sympathy for that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you give example after example of people who had been not getting an adequate diagnosis for whom the internet did lead to a diagnosis. Could you talk about that dynamic?
Yeah, as you said, I think maybe I would estimate maybe half of the women whose stories are featured in the book did eventually diagnose themselves accurately from their own research online. And yeah, it's funny because I do think that doctors are very kind of disdainful of patients who come in with their ideas from WebMD. On the other hand, I think, especially these days, doctors themselves are Googling. You know, I had talked just recently, there was a physician in the audience who asked kind of this question, was like, yeah, I mean, the truth is that as doctors, we're Googling too. So the idea that we would dismiss patients who do that is a little silly. But I'm with you that there is, of course, a lot of risk there potentially. And also being equipped with the internet research skills and kind of critical thinking skills to do that kind of self-diagnosis, that requires a level of education and that not all women have. And I feel conflicted about it because on the one hand, I think it is great and useful that women are able to do that. And at the same time, I don't think that so many women should be left in this position where Googling is actually getting them better answers than the formal medical system. I think it really speaks to a real failure that so many of these conditions are more easily diagnosed by Googling symptoms than by going to doctors who just haven't been trained in them and just truly are not being equipped with the skills they need to be good diagnostic helpers here. But yes, it was very striking to me to kind of hear the stories from women who had gotten sick in the 80s and 90s or earlier before all of this information on the internet was so accessible and these patient communities were available to them, and how much harder that was and how much more isolating it was. And yeah, how much longer their diagnostic journeys were without that resource.
Yes, and like you said, that sense of isolation is in itself not conducive to health, I'll tell you. But then let's get to the other side of the use of the internet, and that is for resisting the sense of isolation and organizing both as support and also for change in how research is done and medical schools teach and that sort of thing. Would you please talk about that, Maya Dusenberry?
Yes, certainly. So yeah, even aside from just the kind of help that patient communities can provide in terms of making it easier to diagnose or sharing practical information and doctor recommendations, I think just having access to that community of women who share the same condition as you and have often had very similar experiences in the medical system can be super validating in this context where so many patients are going through this medical system feeling like their accounts of their own bodies are not trusted. And so for a condition like, for instance, fibromyalgia or chronic Lyme that is really still sort of belittled and marginalized within mainstream medicine, I think it's just indispensable to have that community of people online that can sort of be a counter to that kind of delegitimization that is happening in medicine. And as you say, you know, and also can, you know, push for more research and more awareness. And I'm very hopeful that some of the sort of great energy that has been channeled towards like disease-specific advocacy can be kind of widened to make those kind of connections across diseases. And I'm just hopeful about the potential for women to see that a lot of their kind of frustrations with the medical system are not disease specific, and that, you know, a woman with vulvodynia actually shares a lot in common with a woman with ovarian cancer in terms of having to fight for a diagnosis. And so that there's a lot of potential for advocacy on an even higher level that can kind of unite all of these individual fights around a larger banner of you know, women being dismissed in the medical system.
Maya Dusenberry, in your book, Doing Harm, you chronicle quite a number of what I call catch-22s. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the whole category of medically unexplained symptoms, which you would think would be an invitation to try to explain. But time and again, it just puts conditions into a state of limbo where they're kind of disrespected and dismissed, and research isn't done. Could you talk about that as a real problem phenomenon in modern medicine? And I might add, this is not just a phenomenon in the United States. This is Western medicine in general.
Yes, absolutely. I think you really said it well. I think this concept of medically unexplained symptoms has been this sort of residual catch-all diagnostic category that medicine has had for quite a while now, that has kind of allowed it to maintain this illusion that it already knows everything, that everything that can be explained has been explained, and so that anything that's left can kind of go in this wastebasket and is basically treated as if it's not just unexplained, but unexplainable. And so instead of all of the research and effort and dollars going towards explaining conditions that are really poorly understood, the opposite happens. And instead, those conditions get very little funding on the sort of assumption that, oh, well, they must be all in your head. And it has created this very vicious catch-22 for many conditions where the very thing that's needed, scientific research to kind of uncover their precise biological mechanisms, is the very thing that medicine won't give it because it's assumed to be all in your head. And so it's a very hard trap to get out of unless medicine sort of collectively recognizes this mistake and sort of, I think, learns from their history, which really shows that there's been this tendency for many, many decades now for things to be considered medically unexplained and by default psychological until there's that step forward in medical knowledge, and then suddenly they're recognized and kind of treated as legitimate diseases. And it is just kind of mind-boggling to me that there seems to be a sort of sense of collective amnesia where the profession doesn't kind of learn from that history and continues to make the same mistake going forward.
And time and again in your book, you describe different conditions, and they tend to be both, I think, in the medical profession's view and the public view, kind of minority conditions, or there aren't many people to have them. And time and again, your numbers totally belie that. You've already talked about heart disease. Migraines. Mm-hmm. It affects 38 million Americans. Mm-hmm. 38 million, 75% of whom are women. And well, why don't you talk about that and some of the other diseases that you'd like to highlight for which that is true?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, migraine was shocking to me to learn. Yeah, just how many people are affected and how many of those people are actually affected really, really severely who have chronic migraine, which is considered having a migraine, I think, half of the days of the month, which is, you know, I've never had a migraine, but from what I understand, it's sort of unimaginable that so many millions of people are suffering that extreme pain every other day. And yeah, I mean, so many pain conditions, especially, I think, were really surprising to me to learn that 100 million people in the United States are affected by chronic pain. So that includes a really wide range of conditions like low back pain and many autoimmune diseases, fibromyalgia, and most of them are women. And so that really means that pain is our number one health problem, and yet it gets so little funding. It's something like, I think, $400 million from the NIH to study chronic pain. And so, yeah, once you start kind of digging into the numbers, you really see that conditions that have that really big disparity between how many people are affected, how severely they're affected, and how much funding they're getting in the research realm, there is a very clear pattern that the conditions that have that biggest gap there are these conditions that especially affect women and have this very similar history of sort of long being considered psychosomatic, and so have kind of fallen to the bottom of the research agenda.
And that, of course, is complicated at the moment by the uproar over the opioid epidemic. So we're in a reactionary period now where people who have legitimate pain are either being turned away or having to go through even more hoops than they had to go through before to demonstrate they're not addicted to opioids and that sort of thing. Could you comment on the current situation?
Yeah, I think it's a huge problem. I include in the book multiple stories, acute and chronic, who eventually were accused of being drug seekers. I think there's obviously clearly a very sort of racial component here. Women of color, and particularly Black women, are really stereotyped as being drug seekers due to a totally false stereotype that a lot of healthcare providers hold, that Black patients are more likely to abuse prescription drugs, which just isn't true at all. But for instance, one of the women discussed in the book, a young woman with lupus, even after being diagnosed, so she has a legitimate and very serious diagnosis, would have trouble even kind of getting past the gatekeepers in the ER when she was reporting chest pain, because as soon as her heart was cleared, she was told point blank that she was just trying to get painkillers and sent home. And it got to the point where she would not go to the ER unless her regular doctor had called ahead to make sure that she was admitted and treated properly and with compassion. It's a huge problem that I think is affecting women reporting chronic pain or acute pain for a range of conditions. And then also for chronic pain patients who... Most chronic pain patients aren't using opioids, but some of them do and you know, really rely on them as a sort of last resort when nothing else has worked to make their lives manageable. And yeah, in this current environment, a lot of them are being kind of kicked off of those opioids without warning, without a kind of plan in place to give them something else that works. You know, we don't have a lot of effective treatments for pain, for chronic entrenched pain. And, you know, that, again, is because we haven't invested a lot in researching it.
And you also document the role of race in pain relief in children, even citing studies of children in surgery for appendectomies, for example. Talk very briefly about that.
There's really evidence that especially Black patients are undertreated for pain, you know, even when it's a kid reporting abdominal pain, even post-surgery, when obviously there's no question what the cause of the pain would be. So you might expect that there would be less disparity there. And yet you still see that Black patients are less likely to get any pain medication and less likely, especially, to get opioids. And I think it does kind of relate to some other stereotypes that are rooted in these very kind of long-standing myths about patients of color, Black patients being somehow superhuman and invulnerable to pain, which really kind of arose during the times of slavery and to justify not only slavery, but really horrific medical experimentation on Black enslaved people's bodies. I don't think those are consciously held ideas, but I think there is evidence that some of that has persisted to this kind of sense that Black patients' pain can be undertreated and they don't somehow feel it as much.
And I was fascinated in case after case of different types of illnesses as they were newly emerging in the doctor's offices, being labeled as yuppie diseases or upper class diseases, and give a history going back to the 50s of that kind of assessment, when in fact, the reason that it was presenting as upper class diseases, leisure class diseases, is because those were the people who could afford to go from doctor to doctor to doctor. Talk about that dynamic, please.
Right. I thought this was also super fascinating. So yeah, you see, if you kind of trace the history of so many of these female predominant conditions, you see this very similar pattern where, for instance, migraine back in the 30s, 40s, 50s was thought to be a migraine personality that was, you know, a professional perfectionist. And once actual epidemiological studies were done, it became clear that that kind of patient profile was totally not true. The only reason it had emerged was that the doctor who had come up with it was kind of looking at his own group of well-off patients. And now we know that migraine is actually more common among low-income people, equally common across races. And we see this again and again. So endometriosis, up until, you know, into the 90s, was taught as a career woman's disease. That was officially taught in the medical textbooks. And there is a great quote in the book from one endometriosis expert who, you know, was kind of reflecting on the fact that he was taught that in the 80s and said the reason we were taught that was because white women with insurance were the only women whose pain we took seriously enough to diagnose. You see that with chronic fatigue syndrome. When that emerged in the mid-80s and late-80s, the media called it the yuppie flu. The medical literature talked about how the risks seemed to be highest among educated white women. And the sort of implication was that, you know, of course, a real disease wouldn't possibly be disproportionately affected educated white women. So it was this way of sort of dismissing it without acknowledging that, of course, the only people who were getting diagnosed with this condition that had just emerged, that doctors were very dismissive of, would be those women who had the financial resources to go and find and seek out one of, you know, the handful of doctors who were sort of taking an interest in it. And you still see that with Lyme stuff. You know, chronic Lyme is thought to be this disease of affluence where, of course, the same thing is happening. Who can afford to pay out of pocket for treatment that is usually not covered by insurance? And so, yeah, we see this again and again.
And also, this is another one of those catch-22s. They were projecting this quote-unquote yuppie women's disease, the chronic fatigue, myalgic encephalomyelitis, and saying it was highly educated, driven women, many of whom weren't married. And so what do you expect if you're going to, you know, be this raging feminist? Of course, it's going to make you ill, right. You know. And that was like, okay, thanks a lot for that. And they were actually even calling them fashionable illnesses, which brings up the other concept of explaining away unexplained symptoms is secondary gains. Now, I'm very familiar with this because I've been suspected of it for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So talk about secondary gains.
Yeah, so the idea of secondary gains sort of comes from this kind of Freudian concept of hysterical conversion, and the idea being that when the mind was producing physical symptoms, the primary gain that the patient gained from that was to avoid feeling the mental distress. So by expressing the mental distress in physical symptoms, that lessened the mental distress. But the secondary gains were any sort of other external things that the patient might benefit from by being sick. So attention from other people, an excuse to drop out of the workforce, disability benefits, those sort of things. And that has been, you know, another sort of the catch-22s where, you know, if you are sick and you can't work, you want to take advantage of disability benefits, perhaps, but that's seen as somehow a red flag that maybe your symptoms are not actually physical, but are psychological. And yeah, there has been this sort of tendency to see somehow a lot of these conditions as these fashionable fads where somehow there's some benefit to having that diagnosis, which just seems, you know, utterly ridiculous to me.
These are ideas that are held by people who have not experienced the illnesses.
Right, right.
I think we can say that without fear of contradiction. I was really fascinated by a disease or a condition I'd never heard of before, but it seems to explain a lot of stuff from like the Victorian era, for example, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS. Talk about what that is and how it presents.
Yeah, I had never heard of POTS before doing the research either, but it's a condition where when you stand up, your autonomic nervous system is what's responsible for sort of regulating your blood pressure and heart rate to make sure that when you stand up, you can counteract gravity enough to get blood going everywhere it needs to go, especially up to your brain where it definitely needs to go. And if that sort of mechanism that is really, you know, usually works unconsciously fails, blood will instead pool to your extremities and cause just a wide array of symptoms, lightheadedness, rapid heart rate to sort of try to compensate for that, really extreme fatigue, dizziness, digestive issues. And this is a condition that really wasn't recognized until the 90s, or had been recognized but was sort of classified as a form of anxiety. And it wasn't until the 80s and 90s that researchers at Mayo Clinic realized that there's actually this physiological failure of this mechanism that could explain these symptoms. And so, yes, patient advocacy groups around this, Dysautonomia International, when I interviewed their president, Lauren Stiles, she kind of pointed to, like, remember those images of Victorian ladies on their fainting couches? You know, we think that POTS probably explains some of what was going on with them.
And it was noted after World War I as being called soldier's heart, right? Which we would maybe call PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. So it's not only women that have this, but it's kind of been identified as a women's disease. We must talk about chemical intolerance and the growing numbers of people, not only in the U.S., 11 million 13% of the people in the United States have chemical intolerances. I'm one of them. Mm-hmm. But I was very encouraged by some of your research, trying to understand it. I had not heard of clinical ecologist movement. Talk about that from the 1950s.
In the 1950s, the first sort of folks who were looking at this problem, I think, termed it the petrochemical problem, and started a sort of marginalized movement of clinical ecologists who sort of challenged the traditional allergists line on the problem. You know, allergists sort of said, well, there's no evidence of immune response that we recognize in other traditional allergies, so we don't know what's going on here. And clinical ecologists made the case that there was that may be the case, but there seemed to be some other kind of hypersensitivity that perhaps was attributable to some sort of other immune problem, and was pretty dismissed by the mainstream allergists at that time. But I do think that in more recent years, there's been a more sort of open-minded approach to the problem within mainstream medicine, and a new wave of sort of research that has started to look at chemical intolerance and think outside of the box about whether there are other sort of immune or neurological mechanisms that would explain what's going on.
I am sorry to say that on these airwaves in the last few years, this subject was discussed with someone in the mental health field, and his prescription was to expose people with chemical sensitivities to, he said it was primarily a fear panic mechanism. Right. They experienced an unpleasant experience and they're afraid of it again. So when they smell the same smell, it's not the smell or the substance, it's their fear that produces the symptoms. And he advocated controlled exposure to the substances to help the person get over that. And I leave that to others to assess. Right. I liked what Dr. Claudia Miller said. You quoted her in saying that our lack of understanding about this and other things could lead to a new germ theory. Could you talk about that and where we find ourselves these days?
Yeah, I really liked her musings on this too. You know, she just points out that the kind of counter argument against, you know, the whole idea that chemical intolerance is real and has a physiological explanation that we haven't understood sounds a lot like, you know, what medicine has often said when first presented with really kind of paradigm shifting ideas. Medicine doesn't have a great record of immediately getting on board with things that really kind of overturn their previous conceptions of disease. So germ theory and immune theory, these kind of major new ways of classifying and understanding disease were also met with scorn and disdain before they were finally accepted. And so she just suggests that perhaps what we'll see is that chemical intolerance is a whole new kind of theory of disease that explains a whole range of underlying conditions, which to be determined if she's right. But I think that it's a good point to kind of underscore that medicine doesn't know everything, and that if it turns out that this condition that has been so marginalized and dismissed for so many decades actually holds the key to this like paradigm shift in our understanding of disease, that would be kind of very fitting, I think, given this history.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. There is so much more in your book, Maya Dusenberry, Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leaves Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. Thank you so much for joining us today and for your work. It's very, very useful.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Maya Dusenberry. We've been discussing her book, Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. It's published by Harper One. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KGVM staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LaClaire. You can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media.